From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Right now in the majors, there's only one man throwing the knuckleball. And throughout the history of the game, there's never been more than three or four who've thrown it in a season. The pitch is hard to figure out, it's hard to count on, and a lot of people don't really think it's legit. It's considered a circus pitch. Knuckleballers are sometimes thought of as freaks or frauds. The documentary film Knuckleball is about the handful of pitchers, like R.A. Dickey of the Mets, who have thrown the knuckler and how the pitch has given them hope and a second chance.
You know, you're kind of the alien out there that nobody's real sure of, but man, you can really do a lot of good if you're given the opportunity.
Today in the program, we continue our series on documentaries. We're talking about Knuckleball with the filmmakers Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The film Knuckleball is about a pitch that only a few players have really ever figured out. The knuckleballer Jim Boughton says to throw it, you need the fingers of a safecracker and the mind of a Zen Buddhist. But if you can get it to work on a consistent basis, it's a ball that's only going about 50, maybe 60 miles per hour. It's not spinning, but it is moving and it's dropping. And it's a pitch that can take down big hitters like Derek Jeter of the Yankees.
Yeah, that's fun. I've got to admit, that is really fun to strike out a batter, and he has no idea why he missed it.
That's it! Holy cow, what a win!
You could humiliate the best hitters, the biggest, strongest guys. You know, they were at your mercy.
Swing and a miss. Derek Jeter strikes out.
You just swing at it, man. I don't even know if you make an adjustment. I don't even think he knows where it's going.
The film Knuckleball, which premiered this year at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York, is about the pitch itself, but it's mostly about the men who've had to trust it to reinvent their careers. As a sports writer says in the documentary, it's a pitch born out of desperation. Last year, there were only two men throwing the pitch in the majors, Tim Wakefield of the Red Sox and R.A. Dickey of the Mets. And the film profiles their lives and their relationship with the pitch and the men who showed them how to throw it and understand it. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary film. We're talking and profiling Knuckleball, which we should mention we'll be screening tomorrow night. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Today in the program, the directors of the film, Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg, are joining us. And we invite you to join us as well if you like. If you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg had breakthrough films. Their collaborations include Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, which won the U.S. Documentary Prize for Best Editing at the Sundance Film Festival in 2010. Their documentaries The Devil Came on Horseback and The Trials of Daryl Hunt were both nominated for Emmys. And they're joining us today. And welcome to the program. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, nice to be here.
I wanted to start with, I guess, the obvious question. How it is you came to the idea? I mean, what got you thinking about an idea like a film about Knuckleball?
Well, we had gotten a call from friends of ours who wrote a treatment, Chris Schomer and Dan Kogan, who are now producers on the film, about the Knuckleball. And the treatment was so intriguing. You know, you did a great job summarizing it, but it was essentially that, you know, how this pitch that is really a desperate last effort for guys to throw to stay in the major league really encapsulates what it's like to want to follow your dreams. What are you going to do to accomplish what you want in life? And for these guys, throwing this quirky pitch, which is unreliable and takes a lot of faith, it sets them on this path. And Annie and I just thought, you know, the characters are so great. They had the camaraderie between the men. They're really like a handful of them in the past years. Really told the story in the way that we like to tell stories, which is about people having dreams, overcoming obstacles, accomplishing their dreams, and making it a very universal story so you don't have to be a baseball fan to enjoy the movie.
Yeah. It's funny, because I wonder about how you define the film, and if you worry that people are going to sort of put it in a category, oh, it's another sort of ESPN-like sports documentary, which I should say it's not, but I wonder if you worried about that.
Well, This is Annie, and I think that for both Ricky and for me, it was very important that there were other layers besides just the baseball story. I think that, you know, we were really connecting with who these men are. They are, as Tim Wakefield will put it, often the anchors and not the ace of the baseball staff. These guys put in the long hours. They're often not recognized as heroes by fans or by the team, and they're asked to sort of sacrifice themselves as knuckleballers. There's a role that that pitch plays in baseball that is not always the glory pitch. And, you know, we were sort of looking at what was happening with a lot of people, you know, in the U.S. trying to reinvent their own lives. There has been a huge economic downturn. How do you kind of turn yourself around? How do you sort of look at maybe a not expected path and make it your own and make it successful? So for us, we saw so many things that were resonant or could resonate or be relevant to a larger audience than just a sports fan. It's very much about how do you reinvent yourself and how do you find that singular passion that, you know, is not what everyone else is doing and make it work for you.
You know, I guess like a lot of filmmakers, you have a concept that you, and this is how you figure it's going to, or you hope it's going to work out, or you have a plan. I'm wondering, did your plan or your concept change as you were going in any way?
Well, it was interesting because we set out to follow Tim Wakefield in what could have been his final year with the Red Sox, but we didn't know that.
Yeah.
And R.A. Dickey, with his first two-year signed contract in the major leagues as a knuckleball pitcher. So we had what we thought were sort of bookends in a knuckleball pitcher's career, a beginner and sort of possibly the end of a career. We had no idea what would happen. You know, which is any documentary film you go after, you really don't have an idea of what's really going to happen. And right. I think it takes a lot of just flexibility and working with it. And someone said at a screening recently, you know, what would you have done if Tim hadn't retired? And, you know, it would have been its own special story. I mean, Tim does retire. I can, I guess, give that up at the end of the film because people know that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you work with what you get and you constantly revise and you're constantly looking at the truth of the moment and how it relates universally to everybody on the different paths that they take in their life. And that's what makes it work.
It seems like it does seem like you got incredibly lucky, though, you know, and I wonder if you sort of feel like that there are some projects where everything kind of falls into place and like all of a sudden R.A. Dickey becomes, I mean, he becomes a huge national story. He's the story of the big leagues, really, in some ways happening, certainly last year, and now he's so crucial to the Mets. But do you feel like that there are certain projects where some things just absolutely are kind of going your way? And it seems like that's what happened here.
Well, I think we were tremendously lucky. But at the same time, I think in August of last year, we didn't feel so lucky because we had the unexpected, challenge of trying to follow Tim as he was, you know, in quest of his 200th win. And we saw our travel budget kind of break all previous allotted numbers as we were flying from Dallas to Seattle to Minnesota. I think that with RA's story, I mean, that again is it's part and parcel of the knuckleball. It's a very streaky, hot pitch sometimes, and it's a horribly, you know, frustrating, heartbreaking pitch at others. And, you know, I think with RA, it's been really thrilling to see him come into his own this year. And I think that, you know, for Tim, it was great that he got to, you know, to achieve what he did last year. We were very lucky in that from a narrative perspective as well, that Tim hit that milestone. Again, with docs, you never know. I mean, I think Rick, you know, when we first got the story, it was early spring and it was literally, we had to make a decision in 2 weeks to go down to spring training to see if this was going to be a film that was going to happen. And we sort of, you know, just flew down, met Tim and RA in spring training, and 2 weeks in, you know, all of a sudden you're on this train that's leaving the station, and luck does play a part of how a film unfolds.
When did you know it was a film? When did you know, when did you feel confident that this is going to work?
This is Ricky, but I think right from the beginning, part of what we did in going down to spring training was meet Tim and RA, and just... Yeah, Annie and I actually did an interview with R.A. the day after we met him right down at spring training in his rental house. And that became the major interview for the whole film.
Yeah.
And you just know. It's similar in the Joan Rivers movie. You know, I just met with her for an hour and just said, you know, I know there's a story here. There's an openness and a vulnerability. And it's the same thing with R.A. he has a story, Tim half stories. So however it was going to work out in the Verite telling this year, there was so much story to be told with all these guys, the old timers, Phil Niekro. I mean, there could have been a documentary made about each one of these guys, Charlie Huff, Jim Boughton, Wilbur Wood. There are so these knuckleball pitchers are so rich in story.
Are you baseball fans? You too? And did that, you know, did that matter? Did it help or not help, depending on your answer?
Well, Annie, go you start, Rick. And I'll fill.
Well, as Ricky knows, I was a one team fan. I grew up in Minnesota, and I have very strong feelings about the Twins, yeah. who you know have not had remarkable seasons of late.
Right.
But no, I wasn't. I wouldn't say that I knew a great deal about baseball, but I think that's actually to our benefit when we started this film. But Rick has a more unique.
No,
connection.
I would just add that it really did, I think, benefit us to be kind of dumb and naive and ask these stupid questions that baseball fans would know the answers to, because it really made the guys kind of think about it, like, what? You're asking me this question about their life and why they made these decisions, which I think you just, if you're a baseball fan, you just assume some of these things because you have sort of all this back prior knowledge. But I grew up, my husband, Evan, is from Boston. So they were, my kids are all huge Red Sox fans, but we live in New York City.
Right.
And, and when they heard, I said, what do you think about a film about Tim Wakefield and the knuckleball? They started to knuckleball apples around my kitchen.
Right.
The enthusiasm was so high that, we realize it's a story that crosses all ages. And but I did have to say that Tim would, there was one point when Tim looked at me and he said, you really don't know much about baseball, and here we thought we were trying so hard. We were working so hard to study it. But baseball fans, as you know, they're like mini historians about baseball. You can't pull anything past a baseball fan. So you really just have to own up to your ignorance.
I want to play.
I will say that, really quickly before the clip, we were aided and abetted in terms of educating ourselves through the Major League Baseball archivist and through our co-producer Chris Schomer. We can tell you about that later, but they know a lot about baseball, obviously.
Well, one thing you described the knuckler or the people in the film as the patient pitch, and this is kind of a theme I think that runs throughout the film. One sports writer talks about how, we're a society that is about immediate gratification, how we want it now. And a lot of sports is about speed and about power, which is not necessarily what you get, of course, with a knuckleball. Let me play a clip. We'll hear Jim Boughton in this and the sports writer David Lennon from the film Knuckleball.
Most guys in sports are action guys. They want to use their power, their strength to dominate. But in throwing a knuckleball, you don't have to be a big, strong guy. You can get away with throwing at 65, 70 miles an hour.
The knuckleball is a very patient pitch, and that doesn't fit in today's society. It's a pitch that develops over time, over the course of a game, and it gets better as you get older.
And that's such an, I think that's such an important idea, especially as we see men who are, As they confront the realities of their lives, they're getting older. R.A. Dickey, Tim Wakefield, most of the guys anyway have thrown it. It kind of gives you another chance because we should explain, it's a pitch that you can throw when you're older because it doesn't put as much strain on your arm.
Correct. Well, I think that's also what drew us to the story, just this idea of craftsmanship and the old values that aren't about speed and immediacy, but that just work hard and persevere, and you make accomplish your dream, and just in the doing and the hard work and the trying and the learning of your craft is valuable unto itself. And I think we were both really attracted to that part of the knuckleball pitch.
I also think to add, we were down in spring training this year doing sort of a coda to the film because Ari now is the last knuckleballer currently pitching, or the only knuckleballer in the major leagues. So we were down at spring training with him and we were talking to some of the sports writers there. And I think there is a certain nostalgia for the knuckleball and there's a fear that it may be on its way out given what's being prized by scouts, by managers, even by fans and the people who are obsessed with sabermetrics. the idea of these power pitchers and power hitters. Yeah, the knuckleball is sort of the odd man out, and it's and I think that a lot of people really do look at it as a dying art. And there's something that we, you know, we found both, you know, fascinating and moving about going into a study of something like that. Mm.
Some people see it as a trick pitch. You know, they don't trust it. It's RA says it's a. Some people see it as a circus pitch. Traditionalists don't think it's legitimate. You know, for some reason, nobody really trusts it. There's another moment for the film where we hear from sports writer. There's Tony Maserati in this, Joe Torre, the manager, Terry Collins, manager, Buck Showalter, talking about how managers think about it. You know, that they, as someone says, you don't really know what you're going to get with a knuckleball. Here's another moment from the film.
Managers, coaches, catchers, nobody trusts the knuckleball. Nobody. So sending a knuckleballer out there is like turning your team's fortunes over to chance.
Well, you know what? You throw all the strategy out the window, and you have to be a mind reader when it's going to all of a sudden disappear, and there's a two-run home run, and you're kicking yourself and not making a change earlier.
An old manager told me one time, managing a knuckleball pitcher is like being in a rocking chair. Should I go get him? No, I'll give him one more hitter. And then you get some. Should I go get him? No, I'll give him one more hitter.
It's a roll of the dice. You see this thing floating up there at 60-something to 70-something, and you're just holding your breath. You just got to sit down, assume the position, and see what he has in store for you today.
Off the glove of Veritek again.
You know, it's how do you describe the pitch? As people who sort of sports fans, sort of not, but how do you describe the way it looks? Because there's so much footage of that ball sort of coming at you, and I mean, describe a knuckleball, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, you know, Jim Bouton's. Sorry, no. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Tell him Jim Bouton.
I love Jim Bouton's description. You know, it's like trying to throw a butterfly into your neighbor's mailbox, yeah. Something akin to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because we did film it, and we were always waiting to sort of catch that spooky movement on the ball that everyone talks about. And I guess R.A. and Tim would say that the goal is to throw it with maybe only a half rotation. So you're basically trying to throw a ball at 60 to 70 miles per hour that doesn't spin and that hits a very small space across the plate.
Yeah.
And what it will do is when it slowly rotates, the balls, what are they called? The strings on the ball will interact with the air, and that's what will cause it to dip and dart very quickly and have that kind of last minute break across the home plate.
But there are all sorts of competing theories on what this is. Some people think it's, you know, a neurological response, that it's actually an optical illusion, you know, whether or not that's the camp you're in.
Yeah.
But they do break in different ways. And RA has, as you probably know, and I don't know if people listening in know, the fastest knuckleball that's out there.
Yeah.
He tends to put a lot of heat on it compared to Wakefield's pitch. You know, and I think Ari recently joked that, you know, his fastball is about 86 miles an hour and his knuckleball is hovering around 83.
Right.
So there's not a big difference. And I think that that pace also makes it much trickier for hitters to figure out any sort of read on it.
And catchers, I guess they don't hate it, but it's really hard to figure out if you're a catcher.
Well, I think some hate it. Some will say they do not want to catch a knuckleball. Annie can tell you from meeting Greg Mirabelli. Do you want to talk about Greg?
Oh, sure. Doug. Doug is pretty funny because he felt pretty cocky. He always felt like he had really excellent hand-eye coordination. And when he was first brought in to catch Wakefield, the first game, they were up in Toronto. And there's also this theory with the knuckleball that domes are really good for knuckleballs because it's very still.
Wow.
And so it allows allows a lot of movement with the ball. And so the theory was that, you know, in Toronto, they always pull back the dome halfway just to screw around with Tim Wakefield's pitch. but anyway, so Doug gets brought in and he's feeling pretty good. And I think someone, you know, Veritek may have suggested that he use one of the larger mitts that they had on hand for Tim.
Yeah.
And Doug said, no, I'm comfortable with my mitts. You know, it's the mitt I always catch with. And he gets out there to start warming up. And all of a sudden, he said, my confidence, you know, went right out the window because this thing is moving all over the place. He couldn't get his hand on the ball. And you hear in the film, he talks about this feeling of panic that sets in.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a while, it's like it was an interesting relationship between Doug and Tim because Doug became Tim's primary catcher for many, many years. And he was really defined by that knuckleball to the fact where after he was traded to San Diego and then brought back to catch Tim in a really clutch game against the Yankees, there was that whole story where not only was he flown across the country against deadline, but there was a police escort to get this catcher, Doug Mirabelli, to the field in time to catch Tim.
He was changing into his uniform in the car that they sent for him at the airport.
It's
he literally entered the stadium right in time to catch him.
Wow!
Right, and as Doug said, you know, he wasn't wearing any protection that night, which is always a dangerous position to be in as a knuckleball catcher.
That's right. Well, let me play another moment. This is a variety of catchers, among them Doug Mirabelli, Jason Veritek's in here, Josh Toll, Ron. I think I'm hearing Tommy Lasorda in there as well.
I can't remember now.
All right, well, play it. Sounds like Tommy to me. Anyway, here's another moment from Knuckleball.
Everything you're taught as a catcher goes out the window. You have to wait as long as you can because this ball can, at the last second, change direction.
It's definitely a pitch that keeps you off balance. You're doing everything opposite of what you're accustomed to doing.
The first time I ever caught R8, the first three balls hit me right in the chest protector without even hitting a glove. So I knew at that point that it was going to be challenging.
This is for Phil, and this is for the rest of the staff. So there is a big difference.
Well, you know, I think Bob Uecker gave the best description on how to catch a knuckleball is when it gets by you, wait till it stops rolling, and then go back and get it.
Get it, yeah.
Swung on.
It's a very eerie feeling when you do not feel that ball go in the glove. Panic sets in. You're like, what happened? In front of 50,000 people.
That's the risk you take catching a knuckleball pitch.
It's tough. These are all wakies right here, all these gray hairs.
It's down and in. That one gets away.
From the film Knuckleball, Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg, the directors of the film. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, we're presenting a free screening of the documentary. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. Immediately following the film, Ricky will join us by Skype for a Q&A. For all the details, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary film with a love letter to baseball, seen through a pitch that's so slow and unpredictable, no one wants anything to do with it. We're talking about the film Knuckleball, and we're screening it tomorrow night. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg, the directors, are with us. But now, a conversation with R.A. Dickey. We spoke with R.A. Dickey earlier this week. He's written a book, of course, that tells the story profiled in the film. In it, he writes about a meeting he had in 2005. And he was a conventional pitcher at the time, but his fastball was slowing down, and he knew his days were numbered. So he met with Buck Showalter, the manager of the Texas Rangers, who he was playing for at the time. Oral Hershiser, the team's pitching coach, was also there. And they didn't really give him much of a choice. They were going to send him back down to a minor league team in Oklahoma to learn to throw the knuckleball. And Dickey spoke to us from a hotel room in Cincinnati. He's since said that that moment was the end of one career and the beginning of another, but he didn't know that then.
You know, I think any time that you leave behind what you've always known, whether it's your career or who you were as a professional or regardless of how that manifests, it's a difficult thing. For me, it was no different. I was having to come to terms with the fact that I was never going to be who I once was. And if I wanted any shot at chasing the dream of being a Major League Baseball player, I had to come to terms with that quickly and embrace it and relearn a mechanic that could produce a good knuckleball. I had to basically unlearn what I had learned over the course of 25 years of throwing baseball and relearn a mechanic that would give me a shot at having a consistent knuckleball.
You talk about so that meeting you have with Showalter and Hershiser is like 7 minutes. You say it was a life-changing meeting where they decide we're going to send you to Oklahoma to, you know, figure out the knuckleball. And as you're leaving, you talk about that there was this scripture from the Bible that came to mind for you from Romans in the New Testament. We rejoice in our sufferings.
Sure. You know, that's part of the fiber of who I am is my faith and what I believe. And, you know, I've leaned on scripture off and on my whole life for encouragement and growth and everything in between. And, you know, that was just a scripture that I felt like in the moment was a real gift, because it's lonely to be in the place where you're not good enough anymore. And that's what I was coming to terms with. It was, all right, you're not good enough. All the things that you thought that you did well, those aren't good enough. Mm-hmm. And in order for you to continue, you're going to have to become someone new. And I tried to look at it through the lens of getting another opportunity and rejoicing in that opportunity rather than feeling the defeat that might otherwise come with the feeling of not being good enough.
You know, you say in the book that you're this 30-year-old journeyman at the time whose career is hanging by a glove string. Did you think that there was a possibility that you didn't really have it in you to figure out the knuckleball?
Yeah. I think one of the things that made the journey so scary to begin with was that I had so many fears about it. I didn't know if I was capable of it. It was it's a very hard thing to do, to throw a good knuckleball over and over and over again. It requires a lot of skill and a lot of work and a lot of muscle memory, a lot of repetition. And I was going into it blindly in 2005 when they asked me to do it. I didn't have anyone to teach me the ins and outs of it. It was kind of, unfortunately, I felt like athletically I was good enough to be able to get it enough to give them a glimpse of what it might could be. But it came with a lot of fear, and it came with a lot of doubt. But those fears and doubts never superseded my hope. And my hope was that I was going to get a pitch and a weapon that could consistently get big league hitters out.
You know, it's interesting how many knuckleballers won games after they turned 30. I mean, you can really excel at this at an older age.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that I really held on to, was that these men who had come before me had really found a lot of success later in their careers. Once they matured a little bit mentally, maybe they threw it, you know, that magic number of amount of times to where it finally clicked. Mm-hmm. But you would see the evidence that would support that you have a real shot at being good with this later in your career. It's less taxing on your body because you're throwing at about 70% capacity. The mechanic is very simple. It's, you know, the foundation of that mechanic is very sturdy. So you don't have a lot of moving parts. You can repeat it very easily. You know, some things were lining up, and as far as the mental side goes, that were very encouraging. And that was one of them that I could maybe prolong my career.
So at first, you are trying to figure this out. As you said, you didn't have a pitching coach who knew the knuckler at first. And so you're kind of learning on your own. And you write about your first attempt and how it didn't go so well. And you even use this word in the book. You say you felt wretched.
Yeah, well, and that was not hyperbole. I mean, that really is exactly how I felt. I felt like vomiting because, you know, and the Texas Rangers represented one team that thought that I probably wasn't going to amount to much as a conventional pitcher. There were 29 other teams out there, and I had not had a chance to see what they thought about me as a conventional pitcher because the Texas Rangers still owned my rights and I was not a free agent. So when I took the chance of becoming a knuckleballer, I knew that it would take me fully committing to it. So in the course of that first outing, when the numbers were so ugly, and I'm talking, I think I gave up 12 earned runs in 5 innings. I struck out one guy. I might have walked 3 or 4. It was just the ugliest outing maybe of my career as a professional. And they're asking me to do this over and over and over again. And I thought, what have I done? I mean, you've committed to this thing. And and this is what you have to look forward to. This is even worse than what you were as a conventional pitcher, even with the attrition. So it was scary. It really was. And it took a man by the name of Lee Tunnell. Now, he wasn't a knuckleball specialist and couldn't teach the knuckleball, but he was my AAA pitching coach, and he was just so encouraging and so positive and really worked with me to help develop my own personality with the pitch.
Talk about Charlie Huff.
Well, Charlie Huff is a longtime knuckleballer. He's won over 200 games in the big leagues as a knuckleballer. He's been around quite some time and is a real advocate of the pitch. And so in 2005, I started a number of games in AAA and finally got to the place where they wanted to look at the pitch at the big league level. So they called me back up to the Texas Rangers. And when we went through Anaheim to play the Angels, they had set up a meeting with Charlie Huff to kind of evaluate where I was with the pitch, with the knuckleball. And I met him for the first time. And he was going to watch me and determine and tell the Rangers if he thought I had a chance at being consistent with it. And I knew that. And so we went out in Anaheim and threw a bullpen. And he said, yeah, I think you can do it. And so that right there was a real, you know, motivating factor in me pushing forward. And after that, he changed my grip. He talked to me about what I needed to know mentally, about when to throw my other stuff and what kind of mentality I needed even when I had a bad game. He was just an incredible tutor, an incredible teacher. You know, he's on my speed dial presently, and whenever I'm struggling, I'll give him a call.
You say in the book that you either embrace the knuckleball for what it is or you allow it to drive you half out of your mind. Can you ever really control it, or do you just have to realize there's always going to be something that you're not going to be able to completely control with it?
Well, you know, I'm learning about that. I think originally when I started the pitch, I thought there was no chance that you had of ever consistently controlling it. But since then, you know, I've kind of developed my own style and technique and my own personality with the pitch. And although there are days when it can be very erratic, I feel like I've come up with, conceptually at least, a way to be consistent in the strike zone with it. And that's important for me because I throw my knuckleball consistently about 10 mile an hour harder than the traditional knuckleball. And that allows me to stay in the strike zone a little more than maybe some of the more traditional knuckleballers like Phil Niekro or Charlie Huff or Hoyt Wilhelm, Wilbur Wood, Tom Candiotti, all those guys that threw a much slower knuckleball than I did. We're much more prone to having big swings of movement, whereas when I throw my knuckleball at a faster speed, it stays within the strike zone a little bit longer and allows for me to have a little bit more margin of error. And that took time to develop. So to say that it's something that I can't control and is uncontrollable, I think might be a little bit off in my case, because I feel like I can. And I think that might be something that separates me.
R.A., when did you know that I can do this? I can throw the knuckler on a consistent basis.
Yeah. Now, being able to throw the knuckleball and then being able to throw it consistently for strikes, now those are two different animals.
Right.
Charlie Huff told me the first day I ever met him, it took him one day to learn how to throw a knuckleball, and it took him a career how to learn to throw it for strikes.
Right.
You know, I would say for me, in 2007, I was with the Milwaukee Brewers, and their AAA affiliate was the Nashville Sounds. And about 2 months in the season, I was struggling. I wasn't doing well. And I kind of gave myself over to being this knuckleballer that was going to throw a hard knuckleball and didn't care what people thought or who they wanted me to be. I mean, I got real stubborn with having a different identity. And thankfully, that was the right decision. I had spent the first 2 years throwing the knuckleball, trying to emulate Tim Wakefield, trying to be the next Charlie Huff. And all the while, I had lost who I was with the pitch. And I started to really embrace that in about June of 2007. It was then that I really thought, you know, okay, I got a chance with this thing. I really think I do. And from then on, I grew and grew.
Yeah. I think that stubbornness is a theme in the book. You know, I'm thinking about the story with Coach Serrano, where he wanted to pull you and you just refused to come out.
Yeah, you know, I think there's probably an element of that in every competitor, and sometimes it's toxic, but a lot of times I think it really can help save you, and in this case, it did.
It's R.A. Dickey joined us from Cincinnati. They're playing the Reds tonight, and he's got the start. We're talking about Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg's film Knuckleball. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, we're presenting a free screening of the film. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. Immediately following the film, Ricky Stern will be joining us by Skype for a Q&A. For all the details, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll be back with Ricky Stern and Andy Sundberg in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our series on documentary film. We're talking about Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg's film Knuckleball. It's about the craft of the knuckleball, how it's given the men who throw it a second chance. We're screening the film tomorrow night. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg, I wanted to, R.A. Dickey, in that conversation we had with him, talked about something that you profile in the film, and that is the relationship that these guys who are pitching it now, or were anyway, certainly with Tim Wakefield, the relationship that they have with, in R.A.'s case, Charlie Huff, in Tim Wakefield's case, the Negro brothers, Joe Negro and Phil Negro. And that's an important part of that connection that they have and learning from someone who did it before.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what attracted us to the story as well. It's just that this fraternity that they have is really unique in pro athletes. I'm not sure I could think of another one, but that they are really, rather than be competitive with each other, Tim and R.A., even though they weren't pitching in the same league, you know, they could be protective of their art and their craft and how they do it. But R.A. was texting Tim last year when he had difficulty, and there's this sense of they're doing something very special, and it is a dying art, and they reach out to each other not only to share but also to mentor. We were able to go with them for golf weekend, and the sharing their stories and just seeing at the level in which they really rely on each other, because they can't turn to your average pitching coach for feedback, because pitching coach will just say, go out there and throw strikes. You know, they don't really know how to help a knuckleball pitcher if they're in need.
I think on that note too, I was just going to say it's not just the pitchers, but it's the catchers as well. I mean, again, going back to Doug Mirabelli, R.A. called Doug to see if Doug would reach out to Josh Tolley, who was having some difficulty at the top of, you know, his relationship with R.A. catching R.A. And it's remarkably generous in the world of professional competitive athletics.
I want to play another moment. I mentioned how Phil Negro and his brother had really been instrumental in helping Tim Wakefield figure out the pitch. And he talks about being with them and what they shared with him. Here's another moment from the film Knuckleball.
It was just the three of us, you know, me and Joe and Phil, talking, picking each other's brains. You know, why is it I'm not taking the spin off of it? But why is it not moving the way it should be moving? Like, what's going on? Like, nobody could tell me before.
And I told him, I said, all the other stuff you learn about baseball, forget it. Forget your curveball, forget your slider, forget your sinker, all that stuff. All it's going to be right now is knuckleball, knuckleball, knuckleball.
It calmed me. I was at ease, you know, I was at peace. They taught me how to get the feel of a game.
Just give me what you got.
You know, I can remember Phil standing behind me saying,
put a little bit on.
Throw this one as hard as you can, or take a little bit off here. And now's a perfect opportunity for you to throw your fastball if you need to.
Learn how to accept losses without being defeated.
They really got my confidence back. And even today, I can be on the mound and can sense him behind me slowing the game down in my mind.
Keep telling yourself, next pitch I throw may be the greatest pitch I'll make in my life.
There's also a scene where you follow R.A. to go see Charlie. I mean, he mentioned having him on his speed dial, But there's something that's bothering him. So it's a great scene because he takes his laptop and he's got this video of him pitching and he goes to talk to Charlie Huff. I love that scene, I have to say, because it seems so they get along really well. And you can see it kind of – it really seems to be helping R.A. kind of, as he's working it out.
Yeah, in that scene, Charlie had said to R.A., you need to really alter your speeds because there's a certain confidence that R.A. has in throwing an 88-mile-per-hour knuckleball. Charlie's point is that you have to vary it. So at a certain point in the game, you have to pull back on it. And that was very hard for R.A. to sort of not give everything you got. And it did have an influence on his the next game that we filmed in San Francisco. And, you know, but just as you said, their relationship, that they have this ease with each other, even though clearly they don't see each other that often, you know, occasionally they talk on the phone. But it's as if these guys have known each other forever when they get together. It's this bond that they have that no one else has.
I think one of the things that came out during the filming is when everyone got together, you know, for that golf weekend in Atlanta, is that coming away from that, there are certain stories that emerged. They all treasured time with each other. And it was, I think, you know, for R.A., who's the youngest of the group, to sort of now feel part of this larger brotherhood on that level with everybody extending down from Phil Negro, it was really, really moving. The other thing I was just going to say, too, is what I really appreciate about Charlie and R.A., and that scene's actually one of my personal favorites in the film, is it's so honest and it's so humble. I mean, both of them. And I think they realize, you know, they both realize the struggle and the joy.
I think that's why we like the film for kids, too, is that it really illustrates that you don't have to set out to be a superstar. You just, these guys are the workhorses on the team. They're the anchors. And they're sort of the anti-hero hero. You know, they do, at some point, you know, all of these guys have achieved some sense of superstar quality and paychecks and things that have, you know, made the Major League Baseball heroes. But they never set out that. They just set out to keep in the game, to have a position, to be successful in Major League Baseball. And I think, you know, that's a message for kids today, just because there's so much emphasis on the money that baseball players and pro athletes are making and so much about the sort of final, the result, and not so much about the process of getting there. And these guys, as R.A. was just saying, it's an evolving process. They're constantly reworking and adjusting to the weather and adjusting, you know, once they think they got it, they go on a losing streak. And, you know, it's hard to really control and maintain.
I also think, just on a totally other note about connecting with each other, I mean, these guys often are the old men, you know, with the 20-year-olds in the dugout and in the clubhouse. And, you know, there's a point in which, you know, Charlie talks about how you might think it's neat to be the oldest guy out there. But, you know, for two reasons. One, you kind of know that your number's coming up a little bit. But it's also, there's a certain wisdom that comes with being that old man on the field. And I think, you know, the one thing I think that, you know, if we could have filmed more with R.A. in the early stages, I would have loved to have seen him as sort of the leader in the Mets clubhouse, because, you know, I know you've heard the stories about him as a character. I mean, from getting his Darth Vader costume on to motivate, to motivate his teammates, to just sort of how he counsels other younger players. I think that's also something that's really special about who these guys are. They're the big brothers. They're the people who the other teammates can lean on a bit. They have a very special role on the team.
There's a really great moment. You talk about that golf trip, and that you've got them all four, Charlie Huff and R.A. and Tim, of course, and Phil Niekro, and they're all sitting down. They're just sort of chatting. And there's a story that's not necessarily, I mean, it is about baseball, but there's this moment where Phil Niekro tells the story, and I wanted to play it, which just sort of conveys the sense of that meeting, which was they were kind of sharing these stories. And he talks about this time when he was when a scout from the Milwaukee Braves, you know, had come to their house, his father, who's this poor coal miner, and they're meeting with them. It's not necessarily about the knuckleball as much as it's just a great story. And I loved how it sort of conveyed the sense of the dynamic of that relationship. Here's another moment. This is Phil Niekro from the film Knuckleball.
So my mother cooked up a real little quick Polish dinner there, and my dad went down and got a bottle of vodka, like, we'll get a couple pops in this guy, maybe we'll get a couple extra bucks out of it. And it was all over. We're sitting there. He said, Milwaukee Braves are interested in signing your son to a professional baseball contract. He looked at my dad and he said, how does $250 sound to you? My dad said, I don't have that kind of money. I can't afford that. I work in a coal mine. And the guy said, no, we'll give your son $250. So I signed it, got an Eau Claire, Wisconsin contract for $250 a month, $2 wow. a day for meal money.
Wow.
$2 a day.
Yeah, that's meal money. And that's where it all started.
It's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah. From a coal mine.
It must have been hard to cut out. You must have heard a lot of incredibly great stories.
I was just thinking that, but you know, we had to put some. It's basically in the DVD extras because we filmed for 2 days with them, and it was gold. And our Christine Schomer, who wrote the treatment with Dan Hilgen and came on the shoot, and she's one of the producers who's the real. You know, longtime baseball fan, she just said, oh my God, baseball fans are going to eat this up, you know, because it was story upon story of inside baseball and these guys, you know, early lives.
I think the other thing that was so great about that weekend is that they just so enjoyed each other's company. Tim, it was his anniversary, and the guys surprised him with, you know, champagne and cake at the turnaround on the ninth, 10th tee.
Right.
And they were also all joking about, you know, Tim had, you know, the fact that soon, you know, when you get out of the game, you can actually start spending your anniversary with your wife. You can be there for your kids' yeah. birthdays. You know, all the things that you give up along the way when you're a pro player.
What were the challenges that you had in making the film? I mean, you had great characters, a really good story, but it seems like you had to get access to a lot of film, had to be able to move around in, you know, these clubhouses. I mean, how difficult was it actually shooting this stuff?
Well, I'll talk about the shooting. You can talk about the archival, Annie. But
sure.
we knew we were going to be on the road for 162 days. But you know, until you do that and you're trying to figure out, oh, he got moved out of the rotation, or you know, he's now someone's injured, so they're throwing someone in. You know, you're constantly having to be on top of it. And we had a great our DP Charles Miller. And our assistant producer Sarah Lupton, at the last minute they would just get on a plane and you know, we'd have to catch up with them because it was very hard in that regard, just like not knowing when you're going to have a chance to actually sit down with these guys, because in addition to when they were pitching, you know, they're training every day,
yeah.
and then they don't want to. You know, they got to go and they got to sleep or they got to wake up late. And so it was actually very hard to spend time with them, even though we were with them so often.
And I'll just add that I think one thing that we knew that we had to do early on in making this film is basically come to the table with Major League Baseball and figure out, you know, one, they control all of the clubs primarily, you know, with you know, they have incredible amounts of archival footage, and they have historians on staff, all of which were, you know, really, really incredibly helpful. And we rely quite a bit on our partnership with Major League Baseball. So in particular, when we were chasing Tim, you know, they were helpful in getting us in with the right PR contacts at the various, you know, ballparks well, across the country. Hmm. And then in terms of archival, I mean, it was really, what was really fun was a combination of going both through Tim and RA's personal archives and the tape that they had from their early years, yeah. even playing college ball. And, you know, then MLB was incredibly gracious opening up their archives to us and putting people on staff to help us. But I will never forget the executive producers from Major League Baseball. They came in for an early screening of a cut, and they were astounded to see some of the Tim footage, you know, when he was, you know, at the early parts of his career before yeah. he signed with the Pirates.
Do you think that... I wanted to get a sense of how you think documentaries may be changing. Are you seeing, what are you seeing when you look at other documentaries and the kind of things you're trying to create? What are you noticing about documentaries these days, if anything?
I think they're becoming more cinematic.
You do? I don't know if I'd say that. I think that Annie and I are definitely looking to make films that are more cinematic, and Knuckleball is a beautiful film. very well thought out, and that's sort of where we're moving. Yeah. I think some of our early films were, you know, great story. We didn't always have the technology or even, you know, the time to jump on it in the proper way. But and sometimes you have to do that with a documentary. You have a camera that's, you know, in the mountains in Darfur, and it's capturing footage that no one else is capturing, and that's what you got, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think for us, storytelling in a different way, using imagery more impressionistically and music and, you know, storytelling devices in different ways is sort of where we're moving. Mm. But I don't know if I would think – I think there's a big trend in, like, very personal documentaries, people with cameras going out and telling their unique story and finding that they want to be filmmakers. But yeah. I think there's just so much technology out there that's in so many hands that – It's a mixture, really, of being able to inexpensively tell beautiful films and also just inexperienced but really, you know, strong stories coming out of people who just are telling very personal stories.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, to add to that, I mean, I think one thing that we've started seeing more is the rise of sort of, you know, a faster turnarounds on some documentaries simply because of social media and digital technology. Like, I think about some of the docs that have come out of what was happening in Tahrir Square and, you know, places that, you know, where there's a lot of political uprising and how things are happening, are being communicated globally very quickly. But for us, I mean, the only reason I was saying cinematic is I do think that the quality of camera has become incredible compared to where we were even 5-6 years ago. And I think the films are benefiting from that. The size, the lenses, it's just the films are getting better looking.
Yeah. Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg, directors of the film Knuckleball. Ricky and Annie, thank you very much and congratulations. It's terrific.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Remember, we're screening Knuckleball. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. And there's going to be a Skype Q&A. Ricky Stern will join us after the film. For the details, go to our website. Radio West, production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.